This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, August 27th, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. The U.S. departure from Afghanistan is ugly, but how much of it was avoidable? Will Ruger was President Trump's nominee for ambassador to Afghanistan. He's also a research fellow in foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. We spoke Wednesday about the Taliban takeover and the costs of the so-called sustainable stalemate in Afghanistan that many defenders of America's longest war wanted to maintain. Between the Trump administration and the Biden administration, how much of a through line is there in departure plans from Afghanistan?
Well, I think the most important through line is the fact that President Biden essentially accepted what the Trump administration had negotiated with the Taliban. So the Biden administration dithered a bit in terms of the review, and that led to having to push the full withdrawal back. And I think that was the problem. But they did accept the basic premise, which was that the United States needed to withdraw militarily from Afghanistan, needed to end America's longest war, and that the reason for this was because it was in America's national interests, and we could meet the minimal interest that we have in Afghanistan around counterterrorism without a permanent troop presence. And I think that President Biden has done a good job in terms of explicating the arguments for why. But the fact is that this was the Trump-Biden withdrawal, and the Trump withdrawal that Biden inherited, and he chose the withdrawal over Biden's war. And that's something that I think was really critical about what President Trump did, is it created certain facts on the ground that made it more likely that we were going to get a Trump-Biden withdrawal, not a continued permanent presence of American troops that I think ultimately would have led to a lot of American casualties, because the Taliban was not going to accept the status quo. And that's been one of the problems with what people have been talking about who disagreed with the withdrawal, saying that this was a sustainable status quo of 2,500 troops or thereabouts, and no Americans had been killed. And you've seen actually, figures who should know better than to say that, because it's just so obvious that the reason why no Americans have been killed since the Doha Agreement was because of the fact that there was a withdrawal deal, and the Taliban were trying to make sure that they weren't preventing the United States from getting out by making sure that they didn't kill Americans. And actually, it's fairly impressive that the Taliban was able to exert the kind of operational control inside its organization such that we didn't see these American casualties. And thank God.
I don't pay enormous attention to foreign policy issues, especially with respect to war, certainly not as much as you do or as much as foreign policy scholars at the Cato Institute do. But the idea of a sustainable stalemate, I think, as it was described, is couched entirely within terms of American casualties. It's not couched within terms of Afghan casualties at all. And if you include those casualties as part of a calculation, it looked to me like the United States was actively losing in Afghanistan as a technical matter, but also losing possibly hearts and minds if you see the numbers of casualties that were among the Afghan forces.
Yeah, you're right in the sense that Afghan forces were getting hit very hard, and you're talking a lot of death and destruction, not just of Afghan security forces, but also civilians caught up in the crossfire of the civil war. But I think when it comes to American politics, I think that unfortunately, oftentimes those costs aren't really in the story as much. And again, that's understandable, because when you make decisions about America's national interests and how the United States military should be used to support those, it is the case that we should be concentrated most in decision making on what's right and proper for the security and prosperity of the United States. But still, I think that especially given that some of the justification for being involved in these forever wars is the humanitarian concerns or values promotion, then clearly those costs should be part of the calculus. And I think it's oftentimes, it's not stated to the extent to which it ought to be.
Well, and but even if you took a strategic view of, look, we're going to build up these Afghan fighting forces, and then we will have this opportunity to leave. It seemed like the United States was actively losing in that fight for a considerable amount of time.
Yeah, again, the Taliban had operational and tactical momentum. And what that means is that we, meaning the coalition, including the Afghan government, we were in a position in which the Taliban was continuing to put pressure in the countryside and was achieving its goals, admittedly, probably slower when the United States had thousands of troops there, but it was still a kind of slow loss. And even people who had advocated staying understood that there was this slow losing happening. And again, that's where we go back to the fact that I think we would have had to have a situation where we would have a really major increase in America's commitment to this conflict if we were going to slow down and reverse the tides that were occurring on the battlefield in Afghanistan. And I think, again, President Trump and President Biden both wisely pulled the plug on this campaign because it's simply it wasn't worth further expenditure, particularly given some of the challenges of the Afghan government itself.
What were some of those challenges? I mean, aside from, it felt like the U.S. and the Afghan government sort of captives of each other in a way. But what were the specific challenges of the Afghan government?
Well, one of the biggest problems that we faced trying to help support the host nation, the government of Afghanistan, was that there was endemic corruption that was exacerbated by well-intentioned but still problematic infusions, massive infusions of money. And that fueled corruption that is endemic to Afghan society and the Afghan government. The other problem too is that you're building a dependent in which there's actually an incentive you're creating for the government not to solve some of these challenges, because the worst success in some ways would have been for not to us or humanity, but for those who had become dependents would have been success.
Walk me through that a little bit. I think I understand what you're saying, but just the idea
it's a little bit like the March of Dimes problem, right? Once you solve the problem your institution is designed for, then how do you keep the money flowing? How do you keep the resources, attention, and energies flowing? And in this case, the donor wasn't like the March of Dimes, people. It's the American taxpayers. How do you justify that? And I'm not saying that there was a kind of purposeful effort to not win. It's simply that the incentives were quite different than, for example, the incentives of the American GIs in World War II, who were sent over there for until we quote unquote won the war, right? And had a strong incentive to resolve the conflict one way or the other. There's a real problem in the sense that whether it's the problems of foreign aid that have been discussed widely by classical liberal scholars and economists, to even just the problems of moral hazard in well-intentioned policy to make us safer, right? That it creates bad incentives. And I think we've done that a lot in our foreign policy. And that's one of the challenges is that how do you push enough, right? Cajole enough to get movement, but at the same time, not inducing the dependent, if you will, to go to flatline. And so it's a very difficult thing for this kind of, in a way, principal agent relationship that we developed.
With respect to, there's a lot of jockeying right now for position to lay so much blame at Joe Biden for the technical elements of this pullout, the timing of it. How much of that could have been avoided, given the short time frame that at least Donald Trump's plan to leave Afghanistan was handed to Joe Biden? With, you know, it, was that avoidable?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a lot of room for holding people accountable, you know, ahead, but not just accountable for some of the problems faced by the immediate evacuation, but for the 20 years in which the United States has been spending precious blood and treasure in Afghanistan. And we saw this with the Afghan papers that the Washington Post published, where you had our leaders telling us things, you know, misleading us about the progress that was being made in Afghanistan, when in reality, they had very little clue how to achieve the expanded war aims that really doomed the project. And it might be good to kind of back up and think about that. Like, why were we in Afghanistan? I mean, unfortunately, we have some viewers or listeners who probably weren't even born when this war kicked off, and they may not understand wholly what we were doing in the first place. And I think it's important to talk about what we were trying to achieve, or what we needed to achieve. I mean, the United States needed to do three things in Afghanistan. It needed to punish the Taliban for its state support of al-Qaeda. It needed to decimate or attrit al-Qaeda as an effective terrorist organization with the intent and capability to harm the United States. And it needed to kill or capture Osama bin Laden. And those things were all accomplished relatively early, in, you know, especially compared to the 20-year span of this war. And I think that the problem was that we expanded the war aims well beyond what was accomplishable, but even more important in some ways, what was required, right? So this became a war of choice. We didn't need to do this for our security or our prosperity, or to safeguard a liberal democratic system here at home. Instead, these were nice to haves, or these were things that it's really not the proper role of government, you know, to perform. It's not the role of the United States government in the system that we have, a liberal system in which the government is our agent, right? We're the principal. The government is supposed to support the protection of our property rights, both individually and collectively, against aggressors, foreign or domestic. And so we took upon ourselves the notion that we had to spread our values. We had to build schools in Helmand. We needed to change Afghan society. We needed to promote human rights. We needed to create a centralized government that could effectively govern the Afghan space. And this was a fool's errand. There was no way we were going to do that. And part of that is a hubris about what America could accomplish. And you know, one of the great things about America is that, you know, we don't like to accept limits. We, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we could go to the moon. It's one of the reasons why we could, you know, build such a great country. You know, and I think individuals, businesses, civil society groups have done some of the best things in America. But even our government has performed, you know, in some cases, in ways that have been, you know, daunting or amazing. Right? You think about you know, the kind of arsenal of democracy we became during World War II. It was quite remarkable. So we have a kind of can-do spirit. And one of the problems is that can lead to hubris. It can lead to, you know, a kind of immaturity. And I think that's what happened. We can do this. We can change Afghan society. Their culture isn't sticky. These constraints can be overcome because of kind of that can-do spirit and the fact that, you know, who are these people, right? You hear these derogatory, you know, kind of notions about Afghans, right? A simple people. How could they just use, you know, AK-47s and cell phones and things like this to overcome our, you know, superior military? But it was just so filled with kind of problematic assumptions, and you saw what happened.
There was a point at which then ex-President Trump said Joe Biden should get these troops out of Afghanistan earlier. This was a statement that he had made on his personal website that has since vanished from that website. And a lot of Republicans, especially, I suspect, of the neoconservative variety, hoping to make a neocon comeback of sorts, are just champing at the bit to blame President Biden for this "quote unquote" hasty withdrawal. How do you see it?
Yeah, you heard those terms "hasty" and "precipitous" thrown around quite a bit, even during President Trump's tenure in the Oval Office. But it's remarkable, right? I mean, we've had since the Doha Agreement in February of 2020. Even Henry Kissinger in The Economist talked about, you know, we haven't given our allies enough warning. I mean, how much time do they need? You know, you think about the Pentagon has known since February of 2020, and they knew that Ambassador Khalilzad was working on a withdrawal agreement with the Taliban. So there's been plenty of time to plan for this, and it has not been hasty. These are bad faith arguments. I hate to say it. And I usually don't like to assume bad faith in the marketplace of ideas. Just take the ideas on their face and argue with them. But these have to be bad faith, right? Because there's been so much time to plan for this. There's been so many opportunities to succeed in Afghanistan, given the 20 years. Again, if this was actually a winnable war in terms of those expanded war aims. But the Pentagon didn't want, you know, us to leave. The Washington foreign policy establishment, sure, there have been, different voices on this. But in general, the Washington foreign policy establishment, I don't think, favored this. There was lots of talk of like, well, we can keep a contingent there. We shouldn't absolutely withdraw. And there's been a fair number, I think, of Johnny-come-latelys to this once, in the Republican Party, once President Trump said we're going to do it, in the Democratic Party, once President Biden said, but I do think you have a situation in which these arguments are made in bad faith. It hasn't been hasty at all. But because of the fact that people, I think, were hoping that this would go away, just like Trump's Syria withdrawal eventually went away, right? Partly through the chicanery of some of the people that were in the Trump administration who were essentially misleading the White House on these matters. But I think there was a sense like, well, if President Trump loses the election, President Biden will come in and he talks about sacred alliances and partnerships. And, you know, he's part of official Washington for decades. He's not going to carry this out. And so we'll wait Trump out and then we'll hope that President Biden will change his mind. And of course he will. So, you know, and again, it's not to say that there weren't, plans being made. But the fact is how serious did people take it? And how serious did the Afghan government take it?
The political takeaway for the average voter, at least at this point, seems to be, yeah, this is messy, but this was clearly the right decision.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable how actually well public opinion has held up in the face of an almost constant news barrage by journalists who are in the front of the paper and meant to tell us the story, but who are in fact opining about what we ought to be doing. And I think that you've seen that. There was a New York Magazine piece just on this. That came out, I think, today that, I think the listeners should have a look at. It was really interesting. But what you've seen is that the public supported this roughly around, two-thirds of the public, 70%. And that includes veterans and military households. So, and this is a range of different polls. This isn't just cherry-picking a push poll. I mean, good polling, different organizations doing it, and pretty fair questions, about two-thirds, 70% of the public. Then when you saw some of those scenes from Kabul, you saw things drift down a little bit, but it still held in the mid to high 50s. And there's been a lot of stability in this over time, too. I mean, it's not as if it is simply, over the last 18 months that you've seen it at that level. There's been a lot of talk for years about how the public is less sanguine about this war than people here in Washington. Now, there was a really interesting poll today came out from I think it was highlighted in Morning Consult, and what it talked about or what it noted is that it asked if the U.S. should still withdraw its military presence in Afghanistan if it means it creates an opening for Al Qaeda and other terrorist groups to establish operations in Afghanistan. I mean, it'd be hard to imagine something being more of a push to get the respondent to say, well, no, we shouldn't withdraw. And yet,
yeah, if you'd asked that question in mid 2002,
yeah, I mean,
it seems pretty clear what the intent of that question is.
Yeah. And if you had asked in 2002, should we withdraw, I think a lot of even realists and restrainers would have said no. I mean, I myself, for example, supported the original war aims and our original fight there in Afghanistan and thought it was necessary on security grounds. And I think a lot of restrainers did. But this this poll, it was 45% said still withdraw and 40% said don't withdraw. That's a pretty amazing number that you got a plurality still in favor of still withdraw, given the wording of that. I mean, I think it's remarkable. And I think it shows you that public opinion on this is not soft like it can be on other issues, especially in foreign policy, where elite cues are so important to framing and shaping public opinion. But I think in this case, I think, first of all, Republicans were educated by President Trump about the problems of these forever wars or ending endless wars. And then there's always been a constituency on the Democratic side. Again, there's a battle going on within, kind of Democratic foreign policy circles between kind of more progressive restrainers like Ro Khanna, Bernie Sanders, people like that, and your more traditional liberal interventionists that were important during the Obama administration and led us into Libya. But it also been supportive of even the Iraq War and kind of harkening back to Madeleine Albright's really hubristic statements about how, the United States stands taller and sees further. And that's why we can do all these things. Right. So but what you have is that you have A, President Trump has educated these Republican voters. B, President Biden, once he signed on, that had an effect, I think, in helping. And especially because I think President Biden did a great job in explaining why. And I think some of those statements by President Biden were among the better explanations for the realist arguments that you're going to see from presidents in a country that is very loath to make realist-like statements about our foreign policy. I mean, if you think about how people talk about this, it tends to be within the framework of liberalism as opposed to realism. But President Biden, I'll give him credit for making that case in a very prudentialist way. And so I think you have a public that's pretty firm around this. And the other thing, too, we shouldn't forget is that there is the lamp of experience that guides us on this, not just, Washington foreign policy scholars, but just the general public. They've seen 20 years of conflict. They haven't seen things working out very well. If they pay attention at all to Afghanistan, where's the good news, right? And again, people talk about, well, in Kabul, there's been this, proliferation of building and expansion of women's rights. And there is some of that for sure. But the news has not been very great in Afghanistan over the last 20 years. And some of the hallmark things were things that should have allowed us to think about getting out, like the killing of Osama bin Laden. And if one of the remarkable things we saw this past weekend was Admiral Mike Mullen, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he came out and said that we should have got out earlier. And, so you're really seeing, I think, some key elites and the public generally supportive of this and it's stuck. And I have been heartened that President Biden seems to have stiffened his spine around this and is not going to flinch.
It has been interesting to see the politics sort of take shape on this so quickly. It appears, at least to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of the people who just want to be critical of this president for making a difficult decision that was, in my view, clearly putting American interests above the interests of anybody else, was the hope that the technicalities of the withdrawal, the technical problems with this withdrawal from Afghanistan, would hopefully swamp all of the bad news that we've had about Afghanistan for several years running, including severely being misled about progress that we just learned about 2 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that obviously the evacuation troubles have challenged Americans to try to make that distinction, right? To make that, I think, nuanced and correct distinction that the decision to withdraw can be assessed separately from how the administration has been implementing this. And I think, so given some of the poll numbers we've seen, I think Americans have generally done that. And it may be, too, that Americans have been educated about the status of our 20-year project by the fact that the Afghan government collapsed so quickly. I mean, to me, you look at the scenes as you know, the Afghan military melted away, as political leaders fled the country, as there appeared to be really little legitimacy that the government had built over these 20 years. I think people looked at that and they said, geez, man, if I didn't think it was time to go before, it seems like there's wasn't a lot there that we were actually had created. And if they had supported President Trump or President Biden, I think it buttressed, the firmness of their opinions.
How much of this is going to stick as a lesson? Because that's the scary thing about this is the potential that we're not going to learn this, or the salience of this event, recognizing that this was a good call, will not last for more than a few years.
Well, I think some of your pessimism is warranted here, because the Iraq War should have taught us a huge lesson about the problems of trying to engage in remaking countries in the Middle East or engaging in regime change. And yet you saw, again, it taught us something, because we didn't end up using a large force in Libya, but we did depose the Libyan government. And then it surprised me that anybody was surprised that things didn't go swimmingly after doing that, because we had had the lesson of Iraq. I mean, in Libya, which is an underrated debacle that President Obama set us on that path there, as well as, you know, some of his key staffers like Hillary Clinton and others. It's underrated, right? You know, arms flowed out, terrorists flowed in. There was a civil conflict. It destabilized states like Mali, and then it provoked a refugee crisis to Europe that then had some effects on the politics of Europe, including promoting, more ugly elements of European political scene. So it's underrated. But even leaving aside the Iraq War, the Vietnam War wasn't that long ago, right? I mean, we have a lot of boomers still around today, and the boomers allegedly cut their teeth in, the summer of 68 and whatnot, right? I mean, it was about peace and love, right? And yet the peace and love generation didn't seem to learn the lesson of Vietnam, which should have lasted much longer. And certainly I think that, it's so odd today hearing people talk about Saigon and comparing Afghanistan to Saigon as if what happened at Saigon ultimately wasn't something that needed to happen. It was ultimately that the withdrawal of our forces from Vietnam was better for the United States national interests. It saved a lot of American lives, stopping our support, our war in Vietnam. And who looks, I really raise a question, like, who looks fondly on the, 58,000 Americans who died in that war? Who looks fondly on a war like that, that ultimately led to a complete loss? And yet you heard just strange revisionism about, the early and mid 70s in the debate about Afghanistan. And I do ultimately think that Americans and the history books will look back at this period and say, yeah, it was the right thing to do. And why did it take us so darn long to leave? I think that's the case. But I do worry that the messiness of the evacuation, and I think there was going to be messiness one way or another when we got out of this. And in fact, you could argue that one of the worst case results would have been a really messy fight in the major cities like Kabul, in which innocent Afghans were caught in the crossfire, and you could have seen lots of civilian casualties and a pretty heated battles, and still leading to the same result of the Taliban you know, overthrowing the government of Afghanistan. But I think that very much the critiques of Biden, some of them are responsible, right? I mean, I have friends in the national security community who I think are fair, and some of them even support withdrawal, who have been very critical of the Biden administration's implementation. And I take those people on that they're acting in good faith. I think there are a lot of others, though, that are simply trying to undermine withdrawal and undermine the bigger fight for realism and restraint, against realism and restraint, that is now kind of fully pitched, right, between primacy and restraint. And it's been brewing for some time now. And I think that, that there's a purposeful attempt to try to say, look, these withdrawals were a mistake. They're hasty. We could have sustained something different. We could have sustained our the forces we had there. And, you know, look, it's those restrainers that got us into this. That couldn't be anything further from the truth, of course. But I think that the primacist status quo elite, what President Biden called the blob, they're very eager to try to regain, you know, their hegemony, if you will.
But it's also, you know, if you're a dedicated Trump supporter, this was a key element of his campaign. This was a part of his speeches of his proxies, his supporters who are going out and giving speeches. Ending the forever wars was a key element of that. And it seems to me that there's a pretty reasonable and strong case to be made that the America firsters in the United States can say, yeah, this America first means not making massive mistakes like getting into wars that last a long time where we have to leave ignominiously.
Right. And that's why when we talk about accountability, we need to be talking about accountability for this 20-year problem, this project that didn't work out. And to hold those architects accountable, I think would be useful. And instead, you know, they're still feted, right? They're still the people who were the architects of this war. You know, they're still, you know, getting the invites, you know, to the big events. They're still the ones interviewed by the major, you know, papers of record. They're the ones that are looked to first by bookers on the big TV shows. And, you know, it mystifies me in some way that there hasn't been more learning. I mean, why would we want to listen to some of those folks? They were wrong time after time after time. And I think the reason why people don't want to hold those folks accountable is because there is a kind of general mindset, a kind of shared vision that a lot of people in this space have. And you know, you mentioned earlier about how, you know, this foreign policy is an area where it's an expert led area, right? And I would say it's not a pocketbook issue that it's easy for people to sort out. Like if I said to the average person, you know, is Georgia critical to America's security? They would say like, well, I love Atlanta. It's a great place, of course. And they may not be thinking that much about Georgia, the country, and should it be part of NATO? And so they're looking to elites to cue them. And elites have a lot of opinions about this. And there's been a shared mindset among the elite for decades. It grew out of the end of the Cold War where we were successful. And then as we, you know, pivoted or sustained or extended our primacy. And it's only been recently where you've seen a much bigger share of the conversation and the institutionalization of realism and restraint. Now, I will give great praise to the Cato Institute because the Cato Institute has been one of the, I think you could say, lights in the dark for years and years. I mean, think about the 90s and the early aughts. You know, I participated in the Exiting Iraq project that Chris Preble and others at the Cato Institute were involved with. And I remember people just saying, like, this is ridiculous. I mean, it's the Pottery Barn principle. How could you say we should be exiting Iraq? You know, so at the depths, I think, of the kind of realism and restraint community, when we were at our depths, you know, Cato was a place that was kind of keeping the flame alive. Of course, there were always, academics here and there, but Cato was a key pole here in Washington. And I'll always be proud of Cato for being that pole. But now there's a lot more groups out there that are advancing these arguments and a lot more scholars. And that's exciting. And it should be exciting for all of us, even those of us who have had an affiliation with Cato, because I think it's great to see all this. It's great to see Steve Wertheim of the Carnegie Endowment out there so much. It's great to see the Quincy Institute out there. It's great to see defense priorities. It's just very heartening to see how many groups and institute and individuals are promoting the sense that we need a more responsible foreign policy, one that looks at our national interests squarely and looks at the world as it is, not with these kind of idealistic blinders on. And Cato is still part of that fight. But it is amazing, I think, kind of how it's changed since the late 90s when I first started getting involved around the Kosovo War and in the early 2000s when it was pretty bleak for the argument that we need a different approach to our foreign policy. And unfortunately, maybe the country had to learn by that lamp of experience. I would have rather have had us choose to have a more robust conversation about what American foreign policy should look like right after the Cold War. And maybe we could have avoided some of these problems if we had right-sized our foreign policy consistent with our interests and consistent with the nature of the world around us, because we were in an unbelievably fortunate security position at the end of the Cold War. You know, the Soviet Union had fallen. There were no peer competitors out there at all. The United States had the advantage of having this really powerful military, nuclear weapons, the geographic advantages that we've always had as a country, and no real opportunity for any near great power to try to dominate Eurasia, which had been a traditional concern of the United States. None of that, was a problem. And so rather than, kind of harboring our strengths, meeting some of this, the needs and demands we had at home, because again, foreign and domestic priorities are traded off against each other. Instead, we launched on this primacist grand strategy that ultimately, I think, has proven to be a failure for the United States. Now, we're so strong and powerful, it hasn't led to the same kind of failure that other hubristic strategies have, whether it was the Wilhelmine Germany or others. But the fact is that we set out on this path and it has not been successful. And that's why there is an opportunity for Cato and all these other groups and individuals to provide a positive vision of what our America's role in the world should be and to keep pushing for us getting out of these forever wars and remaking our grand strategy.
Will Ruger was President Trump's nominee for ambassador to Afghanistan. He's also a research fellow in foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast pretty much anywhere and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.